This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Science News. We'll explore the latest research and the intersection of science and society. There's always something fascinating to learn in Science News, coming up next on the audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Science News, and I'm your reader, Bill Shaw, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll be reading from the sciencenews.org website, copyright 2025 for science and the public. And now I'll begin with from the news of animals. 40,000-year-old woolly mammoth RNA offers a peek into its last moments. RNA sequences from the mammoth named Yuka are the oldest ever reported. By Megan Rosen. In the final moments of Yuka, the woolly mammoth's life, he may have been trying to outsprint a cave lion. Yuka's hind legs bear scratches, and in his muscle tissue, scientists have detected molecular signs of stress. Molecules called RNA hint that the mammoth's muscles may have been exhausted. Sequences of those RNA molecules, which offer peeks into Yuka's life 40,000 years ago, are the oldest ever recorded, scientists report November 14th in Cell. Scientists have sequenced ancient RNA before determining the individual building blocks of the preserved molecules. But until now, the oldest RNA sequenced was about 14,000 years old from a Pleistocene wolf. The new work suggests that ancient RNA may be able to persist far longer than scientists suspected, says Love Dahlén, a biologist at Stockholm University. When delving into the molecular biology of Ice Age animals, researchers typically focus on analyzing DNA, not RNA. Quote, I think people just assumed that it wouldn't work, Dahlén says. Quote, so they haven't tried, end quote. RNA has long been considered DNA's more delicate cousin. Textbooks suggest that RNA degrades almost immediately after death, but in certain conditions like the freezing environment that mummified Yuka's remains, ancient RNA may stick around long term. If DNA is the complete genetic instructions for how to build an animal, RNA is the building contractor that tells cells exactly what to build and when. Looking at RNA can give scientists a snapshot of a cell's activity at a particular time, showing which genes were switched on or off, says Emilio Marmol Sanchez, a geneticist at the University of Copenhagen. That can offer information about tissue type and even an animal's health and disease status. Marmol Sanchez, Dahlén, and their colleagues analyzed RNA from 10 woolly mammoths whose tissue had long laid frozen in the Siberian permafrost. RNA from Yuka was preserved enough for the team to uncover some new biological details. The researchers discovered signs of cellular stress, as well as molecules called microRNAs that could potentially play a role in making a mammoth, Dahlén says. For instance, the difference between mammoths and elephants, which have highly similar genetic blueprints, might lie in microRNAs that regulate activity of certain genes in one species and not the other. The team's paper offers a roadmap for working with ancient RNA, Marmol Sanchez says, and that could help uncover new details about the lives and deaths of the iconic animals that once roamed Earth's icy plains. And next, some news from health and medicine. a new cholesterol-lowering pill shows promise in clinical trials. The drug sharply reduced low-density lipoprotein, or LDL cholesterol, levels by Amy Cunningham. A new cholesterol-lowering pill made a big difference for people with an inherited cholesterol disorder. A clinical trial is found in the phase 3 trial. Adults with familial hypercholesterolemia, which leads to high levels of bad cholesterol, took the oral drug daily for 52 weeks. At 24 weeks, their levels of low-density lipoprotein, or LDL cholesterol, had dropped by 58% on average, researchers reported November 9th at the American Heart Association meeting in New Orleans, and in the Journal of the American Medical Association. That's compared with a slight rise of almost 3% for those on a placebo pill. After a year, the group on the drug saw an LDL reduction of 55% on average versus an increase of close to 9% in the placebo group. The drug, enlicitide, targets a protein called PCSK9 that binds to and degrades LDL cholesterol receptors in the liver, leaving more LDL cholesterol in the blood. Enlicitide inhibits PCSK9, keeping more LDL receptors in place. That means the liver can ramp up LDL cholesterol removal. Injectable drugs that take this therapeutic approach have become available over the last decade, but haven't been widely used due to cost and other barriers. Due to a faulty cholesterol processing system, people with familial hypercholesterolemia have elevated LDL levels soon after birth, leading to a very high risk of cardiovascular disease. Even with statins and other cholesterol-lowering drugs available, past studies have found that it is difficult for these patients to meet target cholesterol levels, which can vary based on risk factors. The international clinical trial focused on adults who inherited the disorder from one parent. This type affects about 1 in 250 people. The roughly 300 trial participants, ages 18 and up, were already on statin therapy as per medical guidelines. Two ongoing clinical trials of enlicitide will assess whether the drug reduces heart attacks and other harmful cardiovascular events, and if its cholesterol-lowering effects extend to those without the inherited disorder. Preliminary results for the latter trial, presented November 8th at the American Heart Association meeting, found enlicitide sharply reduced cholesterol levels for people who had previously had or were at high risk for a heart attack or stroke but didn't have familial hypercholesterolemia. And moving to our next article from the News of Oceans. Deep sea mining might feed plankton, a diet of junk food. Sediment plumes could trick plankton into eating empty calories, by Carolyn Gramling. Mining the seafloor for valuable metals could send dangerous ripples through ocean food webs. Tiny floating plankton, the base of the food web, can accidentally ingest particles of sediment kicked up by deep sea mining operations, foregoing more nutritious food of similar size, researchers report November 6th in Nature Communications. That could trigger a bottom-up starvation cascade, even up to large marine predators, the team says. Researchers have long feared that seabed mining could cause irreparable harm to deep-sea ecosystems. Equipment scraping the seafloor some 4,000 meters deep can disrupt fragile microbial communities in the sediment for decades. It can also kick up sediment plumes that can clog the filtration systems of bottom-dwelling creatures. But shallower depths are also at risk. Seabed mining can release sediment plumes into the water at around 1,500 meters. The new study suggests these plumes may be deadly to plankton. In 2021 and 2022, oceanographer Michael Dowd of the University of Hawaii at Manoa in Honolulu and colleagues journeyed to the Clarion-Clipperton Zone in the Pacific Ocean. There, the seafloor is littered with polymetallic nodules, chunks of rock enriched in metals such as cobalt, manganese, and copper that are valuable for electronics. During their first two trips, the team collected plankton and particles using giant nets deployed at depths between 800 and 1,500 meters. They analyzed the samples for particle size and chemical makeup, especially of the amino acids in the plankton and particles. By comparing the chemical forms or isotopes of nitrogen and carbon in those amino acids, the team determined that the plankton preferred to consume particles about 6 micrometers or micrometers wide. The team's third trip was alongside a pilot deep sea mining operation conducted by the Canada-based metals company. This time, the researchers collected samples of particles from within a waste plume of sediment created by the mining activities. Analysis of those particles revealed a distressing fact. They were similar in size to, but far less nutritious than, the food many planktons usually eat. The plume particles were basically junk food, says study co-author Brian Popp, a biogeochemist at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Quote, they had very, very low protein content, end quote. That suggests a dangerous scenario, the team says, should deep sea mining operations get underway in earnest. If more and more plankton are exposed to and consume these nutrient-poor particles, they might starve, and in turn, the creatures that feed on them would also suffer. And now a column on Science and Society. Why do we feel starved for time? New research offers answers. Even with more free time, people still feel time poor. Wishing for an extra hour in the day, by Sujata Gupta. Wishing for an extra hour in the day is a common refrain throughout the industrialized world. And every fall in places where the clocks fall back an hour, that wish reaches fruition. Yet many people still wind up feeling time crunched. What gives? People often view time and time poverty, the feeling of having too much to do and not enough time to do it, as objective and quantifiable. But while inadequate free time is linked with reduced well-being, bean counting leisure hours, quote, doesn't get at the experience of time, says sociologist Michael Flaherty of Eckerd College in St. Petersburg, Florida. Recent research shows that time poverty depends more on perceived shortages than actual ones. Constant interruptions, long to-do lists, and lack of control over one's time all exacerbate time poverty. Yet policies tend to focus on increasing real rather than felt time. For instance, employers and policymakers often regulate work hours. Psychologist Xiaomin Sun and colleagues wrote recently in the Journal of Happiness Studies, given the links between time poverty and issues like poor sleep, depression, and difficulty forming and maintaining relationships, such policies are vital, the team notes. But without addressing people's subjective sense of time, those efforts are likely to fall short. To start, researchers need a baseline for how much time constitutes, quote, enough, end quote. So just as economists establish financial poverty thresholds, time researchers have sought to establish a time poverty threshold below which well-being suffers. To that end, social scientists dug into two data sets of over 35,000 Americans to identify an optimal amount of free time for well-being, 2 to 5 hours of time devoted each day to pleasurable activities correlates with the greatest levels of well-being, the team reported in 2021. Both too little and too much free time were linked to lower well-being. But optimal free time was subjective, says Hal Hirschfield, a psychologist at the Anderson School of Management, University of California, Los Angeles. If a person devoted their free time to hobbies or quality time with other people, the link between excessive free time and reduced well-being disappeared. Conversely, the findings suggest that anyone with fewer than 2 hours of free time daily should struggle. Hirschfield's team is now investigating that question in the United States. Meanwhile, Sun of Beijing Normal University and her collaborators have been investigating the 2024 time use survey of roughly 100,000 people run by China's National Bureau of Statistics. The unpublished findings are counterintuitive. Over half of respondents who reported feelings of time scarcity had more than 1.8 hours of free time per day, the team's threshold for time poverty, whereas more than a third who had less than that reported not feeling time poor. The researchers have begun looking into why people still feel time starved despite having enough time, or vice versa. For their Journal of Happiness Studies paper, over 250 participants documented their activities for 7 days and filled out questionnaires related to well-being and time use. Using a scale from 1 to 7, they rated agreement with statements such as, quote, I never seem to have time to get everything done, end quote, to assess time pressure, and, quote, today I did things in a fast-paced manner, quote, to measure time use intensity. The researchers similarly measured time quality and fragmentation. The findings reveal that high time pressure, intensity, and fragmentation were all linked to higher feelings of time poverty. Conversely, feeling involved in activities, a measure of flow or immersion, was associated with a greater feeling of time wealth. Reducing time poverty requires both individual and societal changes, researchers say. On an individual level, Hirschfield encourages people to conduct a daily audit to track activities, durations, and feelings afterward. This might reveal, for instance, that one is spending hours on social media and then feeling like they wasted their time. An audit, Hirschfield says, makes people ask, quote, what things can I put into practice to limit that, end quote. Systematic changes are also needed, Sun says. Workplaces, for instance, could minimize interruptions and sanction power naps. Ignoring the subjective side of time poverty is inadequate, Sun says. Quote, even if a day were extended by 1 hour, if the quality and intensity of people's time use do not change, people's subjective feeling of time poverty would not improve. End quote. Our next article is from the world of animals. AI eavesdropped on whale chatter. It may have helped find something new. Some sperm whale clicks could be clacks, but what that could mean is controversial. By Catherine Hulick. Dolphins whistle, humpback whales sing, and sperm whales click. Now, a new analysis of sperm whale codas, a unique series of clicks, suggests a previously unrecognized acoustic pattern. The finding, reported November 12th in Open Mind, implies that the whales' clicking communications might be more complex and meaningful than previously realized. But the study faces sharp criticism from marine biologists who argue that these patterns are more likely to be recording artifacts or byproducts of alertness rather than language-like signals. For decades, biologists have known that both the number and timing of clicks in a coda matter, and can even identify the clan of a sperm whale. Sperm whales in the Eastern Caribbean Sea off the coast of Dominica, for example, often use a series of two slow and three quick sounds, click, 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 click. Relying on artificial intelligence and linguistics analysis, the new study finds that sometimes this series sounds more like, quote, clack, 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 says Shane Jarrow, a marine biologist at Project CETI, a Dominica-based nonprofit studying sperm whale communication. Project CETI linguist Gaspard Bégus, wonders about the meanings a coda might convey. Quote, "It sounds really alien, almost like Morse code," says Bégus of the University of California, Berkeley. Based on his team's result, he now speculates that sperm whales might use clicks or clacks, quote, "in a similar way as we use our vowels to transmit meaning," end quote. Not everyone agrees with that assessment. The comparison to vowels is, quote, "completely nonsense," says Luke Rendell, a marine biologist at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, who has studied sperm whales for more than 30 years. Quote, "There's no evidence that the animals are responding in any way to this new pattern," end quote. He notes that each sperm whale click isn't just one tone, but several in a row, and this can introduce ripples into a recording that aren't present in the original. These ripples can look a lot like the pattern the CETI team found. He thinks the researchers didn't do enough to rule out the possibility of recording artifacts. Quote, "I was always worried that this is some sort of artifact," Bégus says, "but we were very careful," end quote. The team found the same pattern in codas recorded by other labs with different equipment, but that work hasn't been published yet. Marine biologist Denise Herzing, who has studied dolphin communication for over 30 years, also objects to the word, quote, "vowel," end quote. People who read that might jump to the conclusion that the animals are using, quote, "something like human language," says Herzing of Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton. Unfounded claims about dolphin abilities in the 1960s and 70s, she says, killed communication research in her field for a long time. Still, the new pattern is, quote, "well worth exploring," Herzing says. This study takes, quote, "a novel look at sperm whale communication using a technique that hasn't been used before," end quote. The CETI team initially used an AI system called a Generative Adversarial Network, or GAN, GAN, to look for aspects of sperm whale codas that might carry meaning. Half of this system learned to recognize real sperm whale codas from data. The other half learned to create its own invented codas that could carry information. And it tried to trick the first half into thinking these were real. In the invented codas, manipulating frequency proved to be important. So Bégus decided to study the frequencies of real codas. To help with this, he removed the spaces between clicks in real whale recordings, so they all ran together. This made it possible for human ears to hear differences between the, quote, "click," end quote, and, quote, "clack," end quote, types of codas. He studied these sounds using tools that linguists use to study human words. Herzing says the idea to remove spaces is interesting, quote, "it's a way for humans to sort of listen differently," end quote. But it's unknown, she says, whether the technique reveals how whales experience these sounds. Stephanie King, a marine biologist at the University of Bristol in England, is also skeptical. She's not convinced that the pattern CETI found is something the whales notice or produce on purpose. It, quote, "might be more likely related to arousal," end quote, she says, as similar patterns across the animal kingdom are often related to how alert or relaxed an animal is. Project CETI's Jaros agrees that the new pattern might, quote, "encode for emotional state," end quote. But he thinks it's worth exploring other possibilities. His team is currently gathering data on the whales' locations and activities when they make these and other types of codas. And our next article from the area of astronomy. Early views of a supernova's first moments reveal a lopsided blast. The earliest look at a stellar explosion shows that shockwaves don't blast out symmetrically, by Mara Johnson Groh. When one supernova commenced, it looked like an olive, at least before it got shaken and stirred. This insight, reported in the November 12th Science Advances, comes from new observations taken in the wake of a massive star's death. As some of the most comprehensive views ever captured of a supernova's first moments. The findings give astronomers important clues about how these explosions begin. On April 10th, 2024, a supernova was detected in a nearby galaxy. Over the next 26 hours, an international collaboration of astronomers sprang into action to gather additional observations of the explosion before it progressed too far. Their efforts produced the earliest look at the shape of any supernova, the explosion death of a massive star, and revealed its blast wave breaking through the stellar surface. Quote, "It's a very important set of observations," says astrophysicist Adam Burrows of Princeton University, who was not involved with the study. Quote, "The modern theory of supernova explosion seems to be validated in broad outlines by these data," end quote. For most of their lives, stars at least eight times the sun's mass generate an outward pressure through the fusion of hydrogen and helium atoms in their core, counteracting gravity. But once these stars run out of fuel, that pressure disappears and the core collapses. The upper layers of the star follow suit, and as they hit the core, they create a rebounding shock wave that splits the star's surface and releases an immense amount of energy and light, which we see as a supernova. How exactly the shock wave starts is a long-standing question. Fortuitously, the shock wave's shape can reveal what initiated it, but this fleeting view must be captured before the shock wave is disrupted by the material surrounding the star, which can take just hours. To capture the snapshot of the April 2024 supernova, astronomers use the European Southern Observatory's Very Large Telescope in Chile, which was able to look at the polarization or orientation of the supernova's light. Using a technique called spectropolar imagery, the researchers used the light's polarization to recreate the explosion shape in its first moments. Their results showed that the light emanated not uniformly like the light from a typical star, but elongated, shaped like an olive. Quote, "The very first particles of light and matter do not shoot out spherically from the star's surface," says study co-author Yi Yang, an astronomer at Tsinghua University in Beijing. Quote, "Scientifically, this is very important because the intrinsic shape of the shock breakout tells us a lot of how it was triggered at the heart of the star in the first place," end quote. While the findings can't fully explain how this type of supernova is triggered, they do narrow the possibilities. The observations support the theory that the shock wave is initiated by ghostly subatomic particles called neutrinos being energized deep in the stellar interior, which heats the infalling upper layers like water boiling in a pot. Just as boiling water bubbles erratically, the star's material bubbles up in an irregular pattern, which eventually averages out into an asymmetric shockwave. This general theory seems to be confirmed by the data, Burrows says, but specific details still need to be worked out, and that will require more observations. Quote, "This is a unique set of data which may presage much better stuff for the future as we start to see, with upcoming surveys, many, many more of these supernovas," Burrows says. Quote, "If a fraction of them can be followed up with this type of precision, I think we will see a new era of dialogue between theoretical study of these explosions and their observational validation," end quote. And from the news of animals, this fly's flesh-eating maggot is making a comeback. Here's what to know. The New World screwworm is creeping toward the U.S.-Mexico border after a decades-long hiatus, by Carly Kay. A type of flesh-eating maggot is making a comeback, and it's creeping toward the United States. The New World screwworm is a blowfly whose larvae burrow into animal wounds and gorge on living tissue. This parasitic behavior poses a threat to livestock, pets, wildlife, and in rare cases, humans. For decades, the United States, Mexico, and Central America have successfully collaborated to eradicate screwworms from the region. But these gash-guzzling maggots are having a surprising resurgence in 2023. The number of New World screwworm cases in Panama leapt from 25 to more than 6,500. The maggots have since been spotted in 8 countries, wriggling closer to the United States. By late September, the nearest screwworm case was reported only about 110 kilometers from the U.S.-Mexico border. The threat has heightened screwworm surveillance in the United States. And the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved the first screwworm prevention drugs for cattle and dogs. Quote, "The screwworm is incredibly damaging to our livestock, our companion animals, our wildlife, and even ourselves," says Philip Kaufman, a veterinary entomologist at Texas A&M University in College Station. Quote, "It's a very nasty fly, and it's why we want to make sure that we can re-eradicate it like we did before," end quote. As the United States ramps up defenses against screwworms and the creature creeps closer to vulnerable border states, it raises the question, how concerned should we be about screwworms? To learn more, Science News spoke with Kaufman and Yan Zhang, a veterinary microbiologist at the University of Arizona in Tucson, about what's going on to slow the spread of the pest and the damage it can cause. What is a New World screwworm? Cochleomyia hominivorax is a blowfly that feeds on living tissue. Female screwworms, about the size of an average housefly, are attracted to the scent of open wounds. They can lay up to 3,000 eggs, depositing a few hundred at a time in cuts as small as tick bites or in orifices such as ears, noses, and mouths. Maggots emerge from the eggs in less than 24 hours and promptly start screwing deeper into the animal's flesh with their hooked mouths, Kaufman says. The burrowing process is painful. Larvae tear through living tissue, leaving dead, rotting flesh in their wake. Foul-smelling wounds that do not heal are telltale signs of a screwworm infestation, and untreated wounds often develop into fatal infections. Livestock are the most commonly reported animals infected with screwworms, but the flies aren't picky about their hosts. Any warm-blooded animal, including deer, dogs, wildlife, or even humans, will do. Quote, "The fly doesn't care what type of mammal that it parasitizes," says Kaufman, who was involved with responding to a 2016 screwworm outbreak in Key Deer on Florida's Big Pine Key. Quote, "It just really likes mammals," end quote. After feasting for about a week, the maggots fall to the ground, dig shallow burrows, and transform into adults. Full-grown flies have bulging orange eyes and metallic blue bodies with 3 black stripes on their backs. Why are these pests on the rise? More than 50 years ago, the U.S. Department of Agriculture squashed the spread of screwworms in the United States. The USDA, along with agricultural departments in Mexico and Panama, created fly factories, facilities that produced sterile male screwworm flies. Each week, millions of sterile flies were loaded onto airplanes and released in infested areas. After encountering barren males, wild females, which mate only once in their lifetime, produced eggs that would never hatch, Kaufman says. This strategy successfully shrank screwworm populations. By 2006, eradication programs had controlled infestations from the United States to the Darien Gap, a natural barrier in Panama that suppressed screwworms from traveling north from South America, where they are endemic. More than 20 years later, cases are climbing in Central and North America again. The Mexican government has reported more than 9,000 screwworm infections since last November. The cause of this resurgence is unknown. Quote, "It was actually surprising to us," Zhang says. Quote, "Within 2 years, they have moved very fast and quite far," end quote. Experts suspect that a combination of factors led to the sudden uptick. One possibility is that the COVID-19 pandemic disrupted production in the fly factories. Lax animal inspections and deforestation in the Darien Gap may have also helped screwworms travel to different countries. The flies on their own can travel only about 20 kilometers a day, Kaufman says. They probably gained more distance by hitching rides in cattle transported across international borders. Quote, how can we go from just a couple of cases to lots of them is when people are not checking animals, Kaufman says. Quote, this creates a lot of opportunities for the fly while we aren't trying to control them, end quote. Other possible case causes include climate change, underreported wildlife cases, or livestock management practices such as dehorning or tail docking that produce wounds. What's at stake? Officials have yet to detect screw worms in the United States. But recent cattle infections in Mexico, located about 110 and 270 kilometers south of the U.S. border, indicate the pest may be expanding northward. The threat to human lives, livestock, pets, and the economy follows close behind. Screw worm infections in humans are rare. But they do happen. Since the current outbreak started in 2023, Mexico and Central America have reported more than 830 human cases as of September 26th. The United States saw its first human infection in a Maryland resident who encountered the pest while traveling in El Salvador last August. Treatment typically involves healthcare providers removing the maggots from the wound. The pest also threatens local economies in border states that rely on livestock. The USDA projected that a hypothetical outbreak in 2024 would have cost Texas $1.8 billion in losses. Kaufman says that the recent cattle infections found near the U.S. border were isolated in one or two animals. The incidents were discovered in routine inspections and were quickly resolved. The event triggered a five-prong protection from the USDA, which included building a new screw worm factory in Mexico and setting nearly 8,000 traps along the border. Quote, we should be concerned but not overly worried, Kaufman says. Quote, we have a good handle on what we're doing. We have surveillance happening all along the Texas-Mexico border from Brownsville to Del Rio, end quote. While the United States is closely monitoring the situation and is prepared for a potential outbreak, Kaufman says, it may take several years to fully eradicate the fly in the region. And next we have from the Sciences to Watch series, Neuroscience, to decode future anxiety and depression, begin with the child's brain. Neuroscientist Kat Camacho roots her work in kids' lived experiences by Mackenzie Perlman. Neuroscientist M. Catalini Kat Camacho spends a lot of time playing with kids. They are not her children, but participants in her research, which looks at how young brains learn to process emotions and how that development relates to mental health. Quote, every kid is so different, and I love getting little insights into their worlds, says Camacho of Washington University in St. Louis. Quote, you really do come to appreciate just how much kids grow in such a short amount of time, end quote. That realization years ago drew her into neuroscience. After Camacho, a first-generation college student, earned a bachelor's degree, she worked in a laboratory imaging infants' brains and was shocked at how quickly they changed. Now she's continuing that line of research by studying kids while playing games and watching movies with them, even going to their homes to understand their lives. Camacho is especially interested in the overlap between cognitive development and mental health. Quote, anxiety and depression are just super common, says Camacho, who now recognizes that her mom struggled with depression during Camacho's childhood. That drives her research today, which she hopes can inform, quote, how it is that we intervene and when and for who, so that we can best bolster mental health in general, end quote. Transcript, Kat Camacho. I'm not sure how much folks know this, but our brains actually roughly double in size in just the first 2 years of life. And by the time you're around 8 years old, your brain's at roughly adult sized. The really big picture of how our early experiences and how all of those things are going to influence our later functioning really start early in those first 8 years. And it also happens to be the age that we know the least about. I really love working with preschoolers, and it's because there's so much social growth happening in such a short amount of time. A lot of those really early building blocks, so how kids in the preschool period, for example, are able to label their feelings, understand each other's feelings, or how they express their own emotions, all of those things are really strong predictors for later mental health. There's probably some neurodevelopmental signals that are there too that we just need to better understand. That can give us some nuance to those like behavioral signals and help us understand who is going to develop these symptoms and can we do any interventions that are tailored to help those individuals. For me, there was a specific moment that made me want to be a neuroscientist, specifically versus just any other kind of scientist. I was working full-time in a research lab and we had just started an infant imaging study. And it was my first time like imaging kids that young. And you could see you didn't have to do any measurements or any processing of the images. You could just see changes in those brains, like in those kids month to month. And that was just mind-blowing to me, just like how much our brains grow in such a short amount of time. And considering that, you know, we think that like mental health problems are all issues that can be traced back to differences in our brains. It just really spoke to me that, wow, we really need to be understanding how this works. Like, how does all this wiring come together? And how do our experiences change this? And so to me, it was just like an aha moment of like, I need to study the brain specifically. That's what's going to help me understand what's going on. It's really important to me that we try and understand the actual lived experiences of kids. And oftentimes, as neuroscientists, we try to, you know, constrain and reduce complexity as much as possible. But I think the problem with specifically social neuroscience is that when we reduce that complexity, we also lose, in essence, what we're actually studying. And so we try to, as much as possible, get out of the lab, like do observations at home or try to make what we have in lab more naturalistic and more complex. So it's actually what kids are really experiencing in their day-to-day lives. MRIs are extremely expensive. As machines, they are expensive to upkeep. They're usually centralized as a result, you know, so you'll have a certain number of MRIs inside this giant university or hospital network. And so that already, just in terms of geography, limits who you're actually studying. So kids are more rural or less resourced place aren't getting included in those studies. And then adding in the actual act of going into an MRI, like if you're a 3-year-old who's never had to be imaged before, especially if you're a kid with anxiety, like it's a lot that we're asking them to do. Personality can bias then, like who actually ends up getting studied. And it's something that I talk to my colleagues about a lot, is just like the kids I'm most interested in are the ones who don't end up in my studies. And that's part of why we really are pushing for more child-friendly ways of imaging kids. The study that we have going on in my lab right now, half of the kids are being imaged using that device. And all it is a cap. So they just put on this little cap and it shines light on the surface of their scalp. And it's like using that light to then measure changes in blood flow on the surface of the cortex. So they don't need to get into a big machine. They don't have to like go through this whole process of being like ready to go in. They can just sit, watch a movie wearing a hat. And it's so much more accessible, especially for more anxious kids. I'm so excited about this next generation of scientists. Like, I think that this generation is going to produce so many important breakthroughs that are going to help move the needle. I'm really excited about the new technologies coming about. So like I mentioned, diffuse optical tomography earlier, which I really think is going to be a game changer, especially in studying kids who are at high risk or who are already symptomatic even before age 8. And so being able to actually include everybody in our neuroimaging studies and being able to really understand how they in particular are experiencing things, I think is going to be so valuable moving forward. So I think despite all the things that we're up against, there's a lot to look forward to in the next 10 years. And our next article is from the News of Science and Society. If another country tested nuclear weapons, here's how we'd know. Trump claims other countries are testing weapons. Scientists' data don't back that up, by Emily Conover. President Donald Trump has called for the United States to test its nuclear weapons for the first time in 3 decades. But Trump's statements about testing, in particular, whether other nations are still doing it, have confused experts in nuclear explosion monitoring. Those experts agree that the main nuclear powers have not performed a major explosive test of a nuclear weapon since the 1990s, when the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty established a norm banning all nuclear explosions. In an October 31st interview with CBS's 60 Minutes, Trump stated, quote, "Russia's testing and China's testing, but they don't talk about it," end quote. When challenged on this claim, he doubled down, quote, "You don't necessarily know where they're testing. They test way underground where people don't know exactly what's happening with the test," end quote. But scientists can precisely track nuclear explosions, and they have done so many times. The last country to test nuclear weapons was North Korea from 2006 to 2017. Those nuclear explosions, which took place underground at the Pyongyang-ri testing site, were swiftly identified based on the tremors they produced and their release of radioactive isotopes, varieties of chemical elements produced in the blast. Seismologist Thorne Lay of the University of California, Santa Cruz, has been involved with nuclear monitoring research for decades. Science News spoke with Lay to clarify what we know about nuclear testing around the globe. This interview has been edited for length and clarity. Science News: how would we know if other countries were doing explosive testing of nuclear weapons? Lay: for many decades, there have been technologies developed to monitor remotely whether an explosion has been conducted in the air, under land, or in the ocean, anywhere on the Earth. This is primarily listening for the explosion. It will generate signals that propagate through air, through water, through rock. Those technologies have been around a long time, but they've gotten better and better over time. For the last 20 years, there's an international monitoring system, which the U.S. is part of. It operates seismic stations, hydroacoustic stations, which are listening to the sound waves in the oceans, infrasound stations, which are listening to sound waves in the atmosphere, and radiochemical testers that are scooping up some air and looking for the presence of any isotopes. It's a worldwide system with hundreds of stations that supplements existing seismic networks. All seismic networks could detect ground vibrations. Science News: what's the smallest explosion that scientists can detect? Lay: it depends on a lot on where it is. That will determine how close it is to the nearest seismic stations that we might be operating for monitoring a hostile nation country. But a rule of thumb is that we can monitor everywhere in the world down to about magnitude 4, the equivalent of a minor earthquake, with the occurrence of an underground explosion, and be able to identify it as an explosion and not as an earthquake. That corresponds to about a kiloton explosion, equivalent to 1,000 metric tons of TNT, which is 1/15th the size of the Hiroshima bomb. But if you're in a place that has a history of nuclear testing where they have done hundreds of explosions, we have calibrated those sites very well, so they could not hide a very tiny event. We can focus all the seismic listening devices on that area and get down to much less than a kiloton. Science News. Is there any way to hide an underground nuclear explosion? Lay. The only strategies that have ever reduced the sound significantly are to set it off inside a big cavity, which has to be very big because the explosion will release a lot of energy. Not many places in the world have huge holes in the ground in which you could try to muffle the sound from the nuclear test. It doesn't completely muffle the sound, but it can reduce it by an order of magnitude or even a little bit larger. That means it will be detected at the closest stations, but not farther away. That's an inefficient way of suppressing, and that just goes to the general acceptance in the research community that we have not missed nuclear explosions. Science News, how do we know if an explosion is nuclear versus another type of explosion? Lay. The confirmation that the events are nuclear rather than just chemical is based on their size. If they're above a magnitude 6, it's very difficult to set up chemical blasts that big. And from testing for radiochemical isotopes that are released solely during nuclear explosions. If it's underground, it requires that the material penetrate to the surface, and that's very common that some cracking above the explosion will allow gases to escape, and they can bring up radon and other uniquely identifying nuclear products that then can be detected. Science News. It's not always clear if Trump is referring to explosive nuclear testing, or tests of non-nuclear components of the weapons. What do you make of that? Lay, it's difficult to say anything useful when it's all in such an ambiguous context. But what I can say, if they were testing weapons in the traditional sense of setting off nuclear tests and designing weapons and improving them, we would know about that. If we were detecting little magnitude 5 earthquakes in these test sites, we would suspect those were nuclear tests, and that is certainly not happening. And our last article for today from the News of Plants, a special shape shift helps a shrub thrive in blistering heat. A Death Valley plant's microscopic morphing tactic might help crops in a warming world, by Siddhant Pustekar. From growing smaller leaves to shape-shifting its insides, a desert flowering plant goes all in to flourish in the harshest of conditions. Summer temperatures in Death Valley National Park frequently exceed 50 degrees Celsius. That's 122 degrees Fahrenheit. During that peak heat, most desert plants hope simply to cling to life. Not the Arizona honey sweet. It thrives by making cellular and genetic tweaks, notably changing the shape of a microscopic structure that converts light and carbon dioxide into energy. Researchers report in the November 7th Current Biology. In 1972, researchers showed that T. oblongifolia best performs its vital work of photosynthesis at a roasting 47 degrees Celsius. That's the highest known peak performance temperature of any plant, says plant biologist Karine Prado of Michigan State University in East Lansing. Quote, these plants wait for the hottest month just to grow fast, end quote. Until now, little was known about how or why the plant seemed to prefer sweltering heat. To investigate, Prado and her colleagues collected T. oblongifolia seeds from Furnace Creek in Death Valley National Park, California. In the lab, they grew them for 8 weeks at 31 degrees Celsius, then turned up the heat on some of them to 47 degrees Celsius, a typical July temperature in Furnace Creek. In both sets of plants, they measured growth, photosynthesis rates, and certain genetic and cellular characteristics. Within 2 days, the plants in Death Valley's summer conditions ratcheted up their photosynthesis rates. Within the next 8 days, they grew to 3 times their original size. Under the microscope, the researchers spotted a striking adaptation. In most plants, high heat damages the disc-shaped photosynthesis powerhouses known as chloroplasts. But at 47 degrees Celsius, chloroplasts in T. oblongifolia stayed intact. What's more, the chloroplasts in a group of leaf cells that specialize in converting carbon dioxide to sugar assumed a new cup shape. Algae have cup-shaped chloroplasts. T. oblongifolia now appears unique among plants to at times be able to morph its disc-shaped chloroplasts into cups, says Prado. Why this shape helps T. oblongifolia beat the heat is unclear, but Prado suspects it may help this shrub trap carbon dioxide more efficiently. The team saw other adaptations that are more common plant responses to heat, including growing smaller leaves with smaller cells, turning on damage repair genes, and fixing an essential photosynthesis enzyme. The new work shows that heat-proofing a plant is not as simple as, quote, tweaking one or two genes or proteins, says plant biologist Yves de Schmet of Vlaams Institute voor Biotechnologie at Ghent University in Belgium, who wasn't involved with the study. All of these many changes probably work together, he says, to keep photosynthesis going when it gets hot. Due to rising global temperatures, the risk of heat-limited photosynthesis threatens crops that feed the world. How T. oblongifolia beats the heat, de Schmet says, might even pave the way for targeted genetic engineering and breeding strategies to future-proof crop plants. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Bill Shaw with Science News. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library.